bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Mean, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Oh, hi, it's me.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody, that's me.
And we got sitting in for Brian right now, Brandt.
Brand news. I just sat down in this chair and they haven't told me to leave yet.
Exactly.
So. I really like this. This is like one of those, like the first time now that you guys have the studio and that's just like a place that you guys are working, that there's just a wild Brandt can just appear and be on camera. And it's not like you're going to Brian's personal home and like waiting all the empty beer bottles to get to a mic or lit area with a camera on it.
It's more of you kind of have to, it's at the point where you have to butterfly. You really got to do a full stroke, Justin. Mm. You can't wade really anymore.
No. Now that it's apparently become an actual hovel. Right?
Yeah. We've got like one weird, big, anachronistic mug, and that's about it.
Yeah. The mug showed up when we started doing the podcast out of here. I don't know where it came from.
Oh, no. Here's why. Because the one thing that as there was a professionalization of the entire operation, Brian's by far least professional habit is that he constantly spills drinks. So he was gifted by our friend Katie Dirks that gigantic mug. So it would be almost impossible for him to ever spill anything that has that kind of heft and weight.
Interesting. Mm. Wow.
Wow.
So in far, theory. So good. I'll say that.
Yeah. I have faith that Brian can indeed re-break that barrier and start spilling the kind of volume that a mug like that would allow. But this is also why you should show up to your show on time and people, your co-hosts, won't just spend the first 10 minutes of the show talking wild, garbage about you.
But yeah, Brian will show up a little late today. He's on assignment for cord killers.
Yeah.
Well, it did not show up late. You know what was on time and actually faster than on time?
What's that?
Google's new quantum computer. I don't know if you heard, but Google has declared quantum supremacy.
Wow. Yeah. So I saw the headlines around this, but I have not dug in enough because I was on the road in Nashville for Politicon on exactly how much pushback there has been to this.
So in there, IBM preemptively published a paper or a statement saying, hey, listen, they did not declare, they did not actually have quantum supremacy. This is it's a setup. It's a lie. It's not true. And so there's a little bit of a war in the quantum computing realm. And to simplify things, we've talked about quantum computers before. The idea is to take advantage of quantum properties and to use basically, what you call qubits, which is like particles in some sort of quantum state, which theoretically allow you to process information at a much faster rate than you could do with a conventional computer, because you're taking advantage of different properties of physics. Instead of a transistor that has a one state with physics, atoms can have multiple states. They can have several different states at one time, and you could use this to theoretically calculate extremely complicated problems. Classical examples, the traveling salesman problem, which is like, what's the shortest path through a bunch of different cities, to maximize your route, where every time you try to calculate this, it gets more complicated, et cetera. So the goal has been to try to prove that quantum computers are useful by coming up with a situation where a quantum computer could solve a problem faster, significantly faster than a classical computer. And Google says that they've done this, that they had a quantum computer that was able to solve a problem that they said if a regular computer tried to do this, it would take, the most powerful supercomputer will take 10,000 years to finish this. Now, so they're saying like, hey, look, it was a very unique mathematical problem for it to solve and not one that has an immediate practical application. But they're saying, hey, listen, this is an example of a problem, though, that was solved by a quantum computer. You couldn't do this with a conventional computer. Now, IBM said, nay. You said that this could not be done with a conventional computer, but what you define the problem so narrowly, because basically Google said, conventional computer couldn't do this, but I guess IBM was saying, but you were was saying that that Google was trying to establish this by saying the computer would do it, but only using RAM, basically saying it could only, there wouldn't be enough RAM capacity to do this. But IBM says, well, if you wrote to disk, basically, if you could use a disk drive to do part of it or handle part of it, then theoretically a regular computer could solve this very shortly. And you did not have quantum supremacy.
Oh, so this is, like, basically IBM is accusing Google of using such a strict definition as to show that this would solve this problem so much faster. And if you were to realistically try to solve it with a regular supercomputer, that can be done fairly easily.
Yeah, yeah. So IBM is saying, no, this is your definition of a modern computer is not really what we would consider a modern computer, and you have not declared it. So I don't know. I'm not smart enough to really have an opinion either way. I think that what I can tell you is that in the last 10 years, we went from, you know, oh, quantum computers, there are too many problems or too many limitations as far as them ever to be able to do anything practical. You still have the problem with stability as far as trying to avoid interference, you know, noise, all this sort of stuff. We've been resolving those problems one by one. And I think that IBM, I don't think, is disputing that we will get to a point where we have quantum supremacy, that that's on the horizon. They're just saying Google didn't get there first.
Mm-hmm. What now? For the Google computer, would this be on like the class of a quantum computer, or is the gain so much in using the qubits, the quantum bits, so immense that it's not even a huge supercomputer yet?
Well, it's, if you look at the size of the computer for this, imagine like a really something the size of a hot tub, you know, this big cylinder that's filled with, you know, super cooled gases where you keep your things, and the actual parts of it do the kind of the computational stuff are like small, but you know, that's mostly piping and stuff like that. But it's a beast. It's fascinating. It looks kind of like a, you know, sort of nuclear warhead there, but
yeah.
It definitely kind of looks like what is hanging in the center of the TARDIS.
Yeah.
It's like a chandelier. This very odd kind of like a chandelier-esque kind of vibe to it.
Now, will normal people, is the jump from using bits to these quantum bits, the qubits, is there going to be a consumer level horizon that this crests? Like, will we suddenly have quantum powered phones?
I mean, maybe that's way down the horizon, but once you have this power, you can solve incredibly complicated problems. And to give you an example of right now is, anytime you want to use something like speech recognition or facial recognition on your phone, you're using a machine learning model. You're using a neural network that was used a lot of computational resources to figure out this very small model, the right things to look for, the patterns to look for. So if you started using quantum computers to create these models, you could create incredibly sophisticated, you know, in a very short amount of time, you could build very efficient models, things like that. And that's one of the things you would start to see would be that the ML models that we're using, or the neural networks we're using, would be way more sophisticated, way more smart. Mm. And it's actually a thing that could lead you to, let's say, better artificial intelligence, not because you'd be running it necessarily on a quantum computer, but to build the model that actually runs the thing, to design the software, to design, you know, the neural network behind that. So that's going to be a big factor towards it. You know, when you want to do research right now, like if you want to do computational research, and I've done this where you'll go to, you know, Amazon or you go to Google and you rent clusters of computers to go run for a few hours because it's, you know, you can run 20 computer, you know, 20 cores at once to solve a problem. With, you know, quantum computing, it's going to affect everything. But a long run, yeah, like I could see that. I couldn't conceive of what it would be, but the idea that we might someday figure out how to put a, you know, a quantum processor in a phone, sure. I mean, you know, it's like asking, you know, me in like 1930s to try to imagine the microprocessor of the 1970s. You know, I'd be like, I guess you could. You know, I couldn't see how, but, you know.
Yeah.
Wow.
It'll affect.
Yeah.
So I guess just to try to like parse some of the intent here, I'm guessing, you know, quantum computing is in such an early nascent stage at this point. Is this particular story kind of Google like having a sort of poorly labeled chart where it's like, oh yeah, that's accurate, but it's a little misleading maybe, and then IBM is stepping in to say, hey, let's temper expectations a little bit and let's kind of see the full scope of what you're trying to say. And so it's sort of like this marketing thing of, hey, we want to show off how cool quantum computing is and we want people to be excited about it, and IBM just sort of taking the detached perspective.
I think that's a very kind approach towards it. I would say it's almost a turf war kind of thing. I think that it's even more so that because IBM's got their own efforts. IBM's doing incredible things with computing and a lot of the pioneering research in quantum computing. So I think, I think it's kind of some people at IBM working on this issue are like, no, that's not it. And, you know, we don't want you putting this crown on your head.
Sure.
And I think, look, with these kind of milestones, history tends to remember the person who crosses the finish line first. And so if Google is coming out here saying we've achieved quantum supremacy, IBM wants to push back if they don't feel that that's an accurate statement. You got a lot of people that have spent a lot of time and effort working on it that I'm sure they want to be the ones to step out and say that we have achieved quantum supremacy.
And to give you an idea of what the stakes are, it's so hard for us to sort of kind of comprehend where this leads to right now. But take a look at like every year when Amazon puts out or every quarter when Amazon puts out their profit statements, you realize the biggest sector of profit for Amazon, we've talked about this here, is their computing services, S3. They make tons of money on basically running a good chunk of the internet. That's really where Amazon makes its money. And that was a thing that now Google and Microsoft, IBM are now trying to get into with, you know, Microsoft Azure, Google with their services, and IBM with the services they're now trying to offer to do the same thing or related sort of fields. Because people look at like, the future is going to be, you know, the cloud, but being able to handle more of it and doing it faster, et cetera. And so, you know, they're looking at like the business model of the future might be, you know, you have some cloud, quantum cloud centers, whatever, processing tremendous amounts of data for people. And that could be, it's going to be a $1 trillion marketplace. So, you know, there's that worry about anybody trying to stand out before or somebody else getting more attention or more funding or more researchers too, because there's a big fight over researchers to work on this, both between Google's quantum efforts, IBM's quantum efforts, and everywhere else. So, I know it's trying to, you know, there's just that somewhere there's, you know, a spreadsheet where they're looking at like, if this works, you know, 20 years down the line, this is going to be a huge part of the economy because this is where computation moves to. So, fun times.
Well, yeah. I'll tell you where you can move to if you want to support us monetarily, and that is patreon.com/weirdthings.
Nice.
You know, that's right. You can go over there right now. Just look at it. Gaze upon this portal wherein you can support us. Keep doing this show. Look, even when Brian's out there, he's got stuff that he needs to do. Look, we just pulled a branch out of our hat. He's on the show now. We're having a good time. This is all because of your support. So thank you to everybody who has done it. If you have not and you enjoy this show, head on over right now, won't you? Patreon.com/weirdthings.
That's right.
What a handsome portal.
Yeah. Yeah, they did a little improvement there. That's good. I'm going to send something to Bryce right now. Okay. It's one of these things where at first I'm like, I heard the headline. I'm like, nah, that can't be right. And then I'm like, I'm going to ignore it. And I'm like, idiot, that's perfect for weird things, because even though it's wrong, it's still interesting and, you know, sort of jumping the gun on the story.
I'm all about the wrong but interesting. Like that can define a significant portion of my career.
Oh, I saw this one earlier today. Okay, I will abstain on this one.
Hey, Brant?
Yeah?
Justin?
Yeah, what's up, man?
Your farm is great. I love your farm. This is amazing.
Well, you know, Brant and I, we've been working this land for nigh on a dog's age.
Got to till the dirt.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. Tilling the dirt and living off the land.
Yeah.
Can you give me a tour? Can we walk around the farm a little bit?
Oh, sure. You know, first we got this fence.
Uh-huh. And then, there's a barn. Don't forget the barn.
A big old barn. Look at that.
Well,
right?
Don't
leave the barn door open. That's a metaphor.
And we got these fields.
Hey, what's that sound? Did something just crash?
Nah, that, no. Don't worry about that. That's farm noises.
A lot of times, yeah, you got a lot of splintering wood around here. Mm. You know, it's the
cows.
Aging.
You probably
process.
Heard the cows.
Probably a cow.
Oh, look, I see it right over there. It looks like, are those solar panels? Like attached to some sort of structure? What just crashed on your farm?
I mean, you got to be environmentally conscious.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, that's what you city folk don't understand. yeah. You know,
we live off the grid.
We, yeah, you know, and so sometimes you're going to have solar panels crash in your front lawn. I mean, I'm sorry it's going to take you a little bit longer for your Postmates, but we do things a little different out here.
Wait, let's go inspect. Should we inspect this? This thing looks like
it. You know what, Fred? I think it's about time for our daily inspection of things that
we do that normally.
This is about the yonder time, I reckon.
Yeah. Let's get closer. Do we have a photo of this?
Tip tap tip tap tip. Those are the footsteps. Tip tap tip tap tip tap.
What kind of farm is this?
Well, you know. I mean, we
do
got
some research
a lot
on the side.
Hey, the biggest thing that we grow is curiosity. For
and
space,
the market is booming.
Oh, well, we are in peak. It's big brain season, friends, and we're the number one exporter.
Care to describe what you're looking at?
So this is, you know, this is a very standard piece of equipment. Again, you dilettantes out there in the big cities, you know, don't probably haven't seen one, but you know, it looks like some kind of satellite with a four solar panels. It's got wrapped in you know, whatever the insulation is that kind of looks like aluminum foil.
It looks a little bit like a really small version of the lunar lander kind of on the bottom.
Yeah. But, you know, again, these are not uncommon sights out here in in the tree. You know, life moves at its own pace.
We take inspiration from all sorts of places.
That involves a lunar lander here and again, you know. I mean, sure, I guess we aren't going to host a Super Bowl, but, you know, we like to do things our way out here.
Yeah, and there's also some sort of red cable attaching the top of
it. It's stuck in the tree. Yeah, the cable goes to the tree. So a Michigan family found this on their yard, and their initial report said a satellite crashed from space. It's not a satellite. I can understand why people might think that. One, satellites don't generally have landing legs. This was a space selfie. A structure hung from a balloon that Samsung apparently sent up to take a photo of itself. And this is a Samsung PR stunt. And apparently it came crashing down on a farm. And
that was there so Samsung could take a picture of itself up in space.
Yeah, so this is from The Verge. As PR stunts go, this one was over the top, even by Samsung standards. The space selfie program involved a photo of Cara Delevingne that was taken on a Galaxy S10 Plus and was supposedly, quote, the world's first selfie sent to space. Users could then upload their photos to a website for a chance to see them displayed on the screen of a Galaxy S10 5G on board the balloon. What the hell?
So you would upload your own photo and then it would spit back at you a picture of your photo up in space
on another phone in space
on a phone.
And let's just clarify, this is not actually space. This is upper atmosphere, not space,
but look at
still
that
cool
selfie, though.
Still cool.
Look at that selfie of Cara Delevingne. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why I made you. I can never pronounce her name. I'm excited to have you take that bullet. So we're looking at an image. I guess if that's a real one, where basically they had the phone was suspended in front of what, you know, the Earth. And again, you're really high up. You see dark. It looks beautiful. I mean, when you go sending balloons up there is really cool. Not taking anything with them, but it's like still not space. But anyhow, it's a neat, you know, it's a very cool kind of concept, but, you know, you actually see the phone suspended up there and you get to take photos of it and see what it looks like, which is awesome.
How long ago was this? For audio listeners, we are watching the initial press conference where Sarah Delevingne is very excited as they count down to see her space selfie.
This press release is dated the 24th. And then I think the satellite crashed today or yesterday.
I'm going to assume that this was not supposed to crash as soon as it did.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure particularly. These balloons eventually come down, and I don't know if it was it got separated from it or if the balloon burst or whatever. I don't know if they maybe followed through on that. I don't know if this was the Galaxy Fold team that designed this project.
I mean, probably not the best results if the biggest publicity that you're getting is that the thing crashed in a farm as opposed to anything else. I mean, also, like, I kind of wonder what hazard. Oh my God.
So
we're on the website for this. Yeah.
The space selfie website now just says, "We're sorry. Mission control can't be accessed directly from your region. To find out more about other Samsung products, go to Samsung." That is so good. And it just says, "We're sorry."
I kind of wonder with what velocity it came crashing to Earth.
It doesn't say here if the balloon was still attached, because sometimes what happens, these things get up really high up and then the balloons burst and then these things fall.
It doesn't look in that bad of shape, though. It doesn't it looks like it kind of muffed up the leaves on the ground a little bit. But other than a few bent solar panels, I would say they could probably clean this up, you know, give it a little bit of elbow grease and send it back up there.
Yeah, there's not a lot to it, Bryce. It's basically some solar panels.
Right.
It's just normal farm stuff. Yeah.
Just farm stuff, living off the land.
I know all you city folks are out here listening to your Paula Abduls, but over here on the farm, we like to take care of things in the simplest manner possible.
Yeah.
So I have a question that maybe you guys know a little bit more about. I feel like space debris is like a real problem. Maybe this is low enough that it is not like would not have contributed to that. But is there not like somebody holding people accountable for not contributing to space debris, which I feel like this could have been if it got high enough?
Well, okay. So when you first this was on a balloon. So this thing, the highest this thing got was like 100,000 feet at max, right? So space begins when you want to get to what you're talking about space, you're really talking 300,000 feet or higher, right? And also space means, think about space when you talk about low Earth orbit, that means orbit. And so in order to get orbit, you've got to be going about like 17,000 miles an hour. If you're going less than that, you just go up and you come back down. You know, you could send a rocket higher than the International Space Station, but if it's not going fast enough, it'll just fall back to Earth. Like, we've had sounding rockets that have gone like in crazy, like, you know, 1,000 miles, like 800 miles up and come back down. So you would never have to worry about a balloon or anything like that being part of that problem. But there is the problem of things that we do put into space, into orbit, because it's not just that they're up there. It is that velocity. They're traveling around at incredible speeds. When we sent the space shuttle up, I think it was like on the first mission or the second mission, the space shuttle came back down and they looked at the windshield and there was a tiny little crack on the windshield.
God.
And that could have been a paint fleck or something from one of our rockets or from a Soviet era rocket. So after that, if you ever see photos of the space shuttle in space, it's actually backwards, because they would let it fly around the Earth engines first. So any debris would hit there instead of the windshields. And since then, we've had more stuff. We've had satellites break up. We've had, you know, like there was a Chinese satellite that maybe accidentally broke up. Maybe it was a test to see for, you know, trying to create debris, et cetera. So that is a real problem. Every country sort of has to assume their own sort of responsibility over that. But, you know, there has been, like, China got criticized when one of their satellites broke up because it created sort of a problem. And that's one of the things there's a lot more talk about, is how do you try to get rid of this debris? And it's one of the things that SpaceX is looking to saying, hey, if we have our Starship, our fully reusable rocket, you know, there are ways in which we could go up there and maybe try to, you know, use different NASA, you know, using different ways to try to clear this up. NASA's looked at, you know, special gels and materials and ways to try to do this, but it is a problem.
I love that you're such sort of a resource of knowledge for this kind of stuff, Andrew.
Just ask the right question, man. You just ask the right question. But it's going to be, you know, going forward, you know, that's just one of the things that just poses greater and greater risks is that we track this stuff. Like you have to sort of everything you put up there, you have to track and keep where it is. Even, you know, there's radar tracking or there's formulas that tell you, oh yeah, here's a bolt that was lost during this mission to repair this satellite or something like that. It gets crazy.
Now, on the topic of the space selfie, apparently Samsung had a response calling this a planned descent, but weather conditions resulted in an early soft landing in a selected rural area, which I think selected is kind of doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence.
All I want to know is whether or not these Michigan farmers are getting a check, you know, from Seoul, South Korea. Like, are they getting some money just to make sure that, oh yeah, no, of course this was planned. Us, this rural farming family in Michigan, you know, in full concert with the Samsung Corporation,
free satellite project. Mm-hmm.
Earth, we call it Earth selfie. How about that?
Yeah,
smart.
Exactly. The first selfie that was in space that's now on Earth.
Now on Earth. That's
right. I feel like Janet from like The Good Place. I want to keep going. Not space. Yeah. Not space. Not a girl. Not space. Not space. But these things are cool. Like as silly as this is, and you know, their planned descent on private property or whatever. It's still cool. I still think it's a cool publicity stunt. I like the fact that Samsung's doing kind of clever, cool stuff.
I mean, really, the biggest thing about something like that is that it's possible to, like, we're in the realm cost-wise of like Samsung looking at, you know, a balance sheet and saying like, all right, well, we have to pay this much for the celebrity and this much for the launching, but we can do a cool thing. Like,
well, high schools have done this same project though, but
I guess that's my point. It's not that it's not, it is the fact that it is not remarkable that makes it cool.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just going to be another throwaway stunt. So,
yeah,
cool. You know, again, like I think we're going to get more of these, you know, things over time. You know, people doing more crazy, cool stuff.
More space stuff or more satellite crashes.
Yes to all of that. Yes to all of that. And I think as we actually start launching things in space, that is the big concern. Is that, you know, one of the things that they do now, like, so SpaceX is their Project Starlink, right? Their goal is to put thousands of satellites in orbit, in low Earth orbit around the world to provide us with internet service that would actually be faster than fiber optic because you're not traveling through, you know, as much cable, you're going through air. And they've already launched some test satellites. They say that, you know, by the end of next year, they think they'll be able to commercially offer some services. And with the Starship, they're saying they'll be able to put up 400 of these satellites up at a time. And, you know, the concern is like, man, like they just filed a request to be able to put up to 30,000 of these in orbit. But the way these are designed, they're in low Earth orbit. So over time, if you do nothing, if they malfunction or whatever,
they'll come back down.
Yeah, then they will end up there. There'll be enough orbital drag. There'll be enough drag that at some point they will actually, their orbit will degrade and they will burn up in the atmosphere. So you're not going to be worried about these things being stuck up there forever. You know, you have some orbits where things could be orbiting there for millions of years, but here, these things will eventually come back down to Earth.
So in very Elon Musk fashion, he tweeted out over the weekend saying that this tweet had, you know, was coming from a Starlink satellite that was the internet that he was using, but that I was kind of surprised by how around the corner they were, how aggressively they're looking to like put this out as like an offering for consumers.
Well, who their first customers are going to be will probably be more like military and some industrial, because they're not going to have a tremendous amount of capacity, but they've already done tests with the military and basically communicating Starlink to like a transceiver that was on board like an aircraft. Yeah. And so that might be early on who some of their customers are, is, you know, the military, you know, needs its communication. So, you know, the idea that that might be an early market for them seems like a given.
So, if you were to, you know, take a guess as to when there would be a commercial offering, and never is a possible answer, when would you think SpaceX might have a commercial offering of Starlink?
So the thing to think about Starlink, which kind of gets overlooked in a lot of enthusiasm for it, is that you have this big, massive array of satellites in space providing you internet. But at any given time over a location, you're only going to have a handful of them providing communications, right? Which is not ideal for, let's say, if you're like, you know, you live in Oakland or Los Angeles. That's not actually their ideal target for there, because there are too many people there who would want to use that small group of satellites initially. So people in much more rural areas would be the first customers, people who have, you know, who are already dependent upon satellite access or have limited access. Because if you've got, you know, if you've got 50 people per square mile, that's probably their ideal case. You look for places where you have that, and that's where they're going to initially sell the services. And so a lot of people like, I want to replace my service. Like, if you live in a dense city, may not be for you yet, because they just can't provide that capacity. So I think that we're going to see early on, I could see 2 years out or so, I think some of the first rural customers, places that are underserved or don't have any kind of access or entirely dependent on satellite, that will be where you're going to go.
That's smart. There's huge swaths of America that it is just too expensive to run glass fiber tubes out there. Mm-hmm. And so they're running on either satellite or dial-up in some cases. That just the scale of how much land you have to cover, how much environment you have to work around, does make that difficult. Yeah. And we're still a ways out from a proper full 5G rollout.
Yeah, and you'll see whenever Gwynne Shotwell, who's, you know, president of SpaceX, when she talks about this, and even Elon, they'll talk about, hey, yeah, we're looking to provide it in underserved areas, rural, whatever. And a lot of times that gets lost on people. They're like, I want to have it, you know, and it's like, well, that's, they're not saying that the person in the dense city is their first use case, but the fact that they've actually, that SpaceX wants to try to put up 30,000 satellites tells you that eventually is the long-term plan, is going to be everybody. So, you know, the biggest thing that's, you know, going to affect this is the sooner they get Starship working, you know, that's a big factor, because I think like right now with a Falcon 9, they can launch something like 70 of these satellites at a time, which is pretty huge. But with Starship, they say they'll be able to launch 400 of these satellites at a time.
Wow.
So, that's, I mean, that's amazing. Yeah, I, you know, I think that like for an average consumer in a rural area, maybe 2 years out, 3 years out, might be my guess.
We just had a space.com report from a few days ago, saying that they might have a broadband service by 2020.
Oh no, they're going to have that. That was going to be for the limited case scenario, but not the consumer.
Gotcha. Yeah, that'll be, you know, you're making that deal at the Pentagon, you know, for whatever, you know, white label version of it that
or UPS logistics or something like that. But
big,
this is
big money players, Bryce. You know, just hustlers, big money hustlers.
But this is a growing area, because you have other satellite constellations being started up. Like OneWeb has already put up satellites. They actually beat SpaceX with their satellites up there. Amazon has their Project Kuiper, which is going to be their own attempt at building a massive, you know, network of these things, because that's sort of people sort of seeing the future. And the future is that, you know, you blanket the Earth with enough of these low Earth orbit satellites and you can cover internet everywhere and forget cell tower. Well, you'd still want cell towers for cell phones and stuff, because these things still have to transmit to something the size of a pizza box. But for a lot of other, you know, home-based stuff, et cetera, kind of amazing.
Can we briefly touch on, I did see that Gwynne Shotwell got a little, had a little bit of a sassy answer to a question on why she believes that Blue Origin has not progressed at quite the speed of SpaceX.
So Gwynne Shotwell was speaking at a forum where her speech was not made publicly available, but there are people that were writing down what she had said, and we've heard some quotes about there from there. And so perhaps the idea that it wasn't going to be recorded or, you know, made available, she was a little bit more
sassy.
Yes.
Look, no matter what, I am always here for the pettiness.
Well, Gwynne Shotwell is amazing. She is you know, we talk a lot about Elon when it comes to what Elon has done, but Elon will tell you how amazing Gwynn is, and bringing her on board SpaceX is one of the reasons SpaceX has been able to do such incredible stuff. She's got an engineering background. She's brilliant. She makes things happen, you know, and she's great to listen to speak, and, you know, she's very inspiring. So Gwynn was talking about, you know, the competition between SpaceX and Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' space company. And Blue Origin started like 2 years before SpaceX. And Blue Origin has made some, you know, done some cool stuff. They had the New Shepard, which was the suborbital rocket. Again, not fast enough to go into orbit, but, you know, went up into the quote space, came back down. And they've developed a new engine that's going to be used by next generation rockets, including their own, which is an incredible engine, amazing technology there. But they've never reached orbit. They've never built a craft that actually has reached orbit. And even though SpaceX started after Blue Origin, SpaceX has built one, the Falcon 1, which was able to reach orbit in space. The Falcon 9, which made it to the International Space Station, is now a workhorse that is doing a tremendous amount of work in the launch industry. And, you know, we've watched what SpaceX has done. They've got the Super Heavy, you know, all this stuff. And Blue Origin hasn't done anything remotely like that yet. And Gwynn Shotwell said, well, you know, Bezos puts $1 billion a year into this company. They're just not under the same pressure. They're just not, you know, don't feel the same sort of need to make this company, you know, survive, I guess.
Yeah. So that was really the money quote there was that the reason why, if you want to see why SpaceX has progressed at a level that Blue Origin is not, it's that SpaceX doesn't have the same kind of budget, and that she seemed pretty dismissive of the idea that that Blue Origin's working on like a 10-year plan that does not put a lot of focus on near-term evolution in a way that SpaceX seems to prize.
And I think that cumulatively Blue Origin has probably got a lot of amazing developments. I think we're going to watch them close the gap. You know, we're going to see them doing some incredible stuff. I mean, I don't know if they'll close the gap completely, because I think SpaceX has so much practical experience there. But Blue Origin is still, you know, like I said, I don't want to undersell some of the things they've done. But when you compare it to like the actual making money doing things, like, yeah, SpaceX is clearly ahead of there.
I just love it because, you know, we and look, this the life cycle of this podcast is really chronicled kind of space access to space being something that we initially started talking about because it was like sci-fi futuristic. And now it is very, very normal. And now we get these kind of hallmarks of like, this sounds a lot more just like a CEO talking, you know, the way that they would about their rivals' offerings and saying, you know, we feel very confident in what we've done. All the best to them, but we believe that we have a superior product for the following reasons. That just sounds a lot more like a CEO and not so, who's, you know, there's a defined pie that they are going to get some market share of, as opposed to the like, well, you know, we're all doing great. You know, we're all just trying to put some rockets in space.
As somebody who's been here for the entire conversation, there is a big temptation to pick one team, like only one can be better than the other. Let me make it clear. I think each has its own benefits. Okja was fantastic. It was a great Netflix original. Snowpiercer, amazing. And Parasite, also great.
Yeah, I absolutely. I haven't seen any of those. But I don't know
what you guys said before I showed up late, but
we did not tell people you were going and watching a movie.
Okay, yeah, no, I was late because the only showing of Parasite that I could see had me showing up late. I apologize.
No worries.
No problem.
Thank you to Brandt, who was holding down the fort.
I think that her point, though, I agree, is that when the SpaceX engineers knew that, hey, if we don't get this thing working in 6 months, we're out of money. That's a lot of pressure, where if you're like, yeah, every year we're going to get $1 billion funded until we do this is a different sort of thing. But, you know, Microsoft for the longest time, you know, had tons of engineers working on stuff that we never really saw. And Microsoft sort of seemed like it kind of fell behind innovation. But then every now and then Microsoft would show you something, you'd be amazed at what they were doing. And I think a lot of the work Blue Origin's doing it may surprise us, but there was a really cool video of like their factory where they were showing like, you know, the ovens and stuff and things moving around and the automation from this. And it just looks like something out of, you know, the year 3000. It was just incredible. And so I want them both to succeed.
Of course, we all want the fruits of these companies continuing to make space more accessible. At the same time, I like it when people mix it up. I was delighted by Glenn Shotwell deciding to, you know, answer any Blue Origin question with scoreboard. Look who's who's doing it now. That's really cool.
And it's better for the company. It's better for them to be the ones that are making. Of course, they're going to think they're going to win.
Get things going, right?
Well, yeah. And I mean, from her point of view, is like when her day to day is great. Elon was up late and walked into the office with a new idea. Now we've got to figure out how to pay for this, you know. And she's being compared to Blue Origin, where, you know, Bezos, you know, drops by and says, here's another $1 billion check, guys. You're doing great work. See you later. Gentlemen, do you want to do picks?
Yeah. Hey, Brian, do you have a pick?
Yeah, man, my pick is Boon Jong. How do you say his name?
Bong Joon Ho.
Yes, Bong Joon Ho. There we go. Thank you. The guy who did Snowpiercer and Okja has a new movie, Parasite. I was told specifically, look, there are people that I trust a lot, and when they tell me to go in blind, I go in blind. The last time I had an experience like this was when one Justin Robert Young said, here is your one and only warning as your friend to go in and see Sorry to Bother You totally blind. And and I did the same thing with Parasite, which normally I would not have shown up late on the show, but it was just one of those things that it was as important to me to see it blind see it. And I liked it. Probably not a surprise that there's some bitter in that sweet. If you saw Okja, if you saw Snowpiercer, then you have a taste for the type of movies this guy makes. It's a visual treat, to be sure. Also, all in Korean. And it's funny because, you know what, that's all I'm going to say. It's all in Korean. And it's a worthy watch. Highly recommended.
And having, I saw the trailers a lot because Alamo is one of the chains that is handling the limited release. And so I know Tom was also telling us, or Tom was saying, like, go in blind. And having seen all those trailers still, it, going in and seeing Parasite, even with that, I still felt totally, surprised by it. So if you have seen the trailers and you think, oh, well, it's not spoiled or anything for you, it's great. It's a shame it's in such limited release because it's just like, where can I see it? Like, where? But it's great.
Man, unfortunately, even to talk, I guess we'll save the rest for Cord Killer spoiler in time because... Like every word I want to say about it in an effort to get people to watch it will only possibly take something away from the opportunity to go in blind.
Yeah. Consider Parasite.
Consider, friends, Parasite for you and your family.
Great for weight loss. Parasites. I already know Justin's pick.
Oh, well then
Justin's pick is a little upstart of an airline that maybe has some... Something going
did.
For it.
All right. I sent a moment for Brian and I's friendship because he has obviously been a big proponent of Southwest. I have not really flown Southwest much, but as my status degraded from my delightful highs of being a recognized passenger on United, I decided to start flying more out of Oakland, which is a closer airport to me. And the big partner there is Southwest. So I've been flying Southwest a lot more. And I got to say, it's I get why it has built up the kind of loyal following that it has, that there are people that just swear by Southwest. And I think that there's a lot of stuff that they are doing that you're just now seeing a lot of the other major carriers. The fact that, you know, with an opt-in, you can just for free get text messaging on your phone is huge. The way that they've implemented live television, I think, is really, really smart because they're running it basically through your browser. But it means that everybody can watch, and it's a lot more reliable than the live television that other carriers have, where you just have like a little television in the back of the headrest. So Southwest, you know, it's an airline. You should probably fly if you like flying from place to place. That's take it from me, kid airline.
It is nice. Like, it's a shame that they don't like let their prices be shown in those search aggregators. But it's like you get free bags. There's not like tiered seating. It's open seating.
That is its own thing. So the open seating is easily the biggest drawback for some people, where you're like, you are not guaranteed that you're going to get into a certain a seat if you love a certain seat or you want to do it. But having flown with Brian, I know that his cheat code is just whenever you're getting on, you're beelining to the very back of the plane and you're getting the good seat that you want in the very back of the plane.
Unless you know, so the first thing I always do is ask, not at the gate because the gate has other things to worry about, but the first flight attendant, how full are we on this one? If their eyes bug out and they're like, totally, completely, absolutely full. Then it's like, okay, just as long as you get a window or an aisle or whatever your preferred flavor is, it really doesn't matter where in the plane you are. But if they say, pretty much full, that's code for, guess what is going to be at the back of the plane, seats that people don't want to sit in the middle of. So then you make a beeline to the back, and then you get yourself a window seat, and then you try to look as gross as possible, and then nobody sits near you.
And also, it's like you're by the bathroom. It was just, you know, I was texting Brian. I'm like, your legacy as a Southwest passenger has been a cheat code to my recent travel. I've very much enjoyed
it. I can't handle that anxiety.
I think that is a big drawback for a lot of people, that you just it is adding an anxious moment to an already for some unbearably anxious experience of clearing security, getting to your gate on time, flying in general. Like, the last thing you want is some scramble where you're like, oh my God, are me and my, you know, significant other going to sit together? Or did we remember to check into our flight 24 hours ahead of time? Like, there is a lot. If that is a no, if that's a deal breaker for you, then yeah, there's just nothing that is going to, no amount of salve that will calm that.
I just don't have the temperament. I just, I don't have the constitution. All right.
What's funny is, as you're saying that, I'm just realizing how different I bet we are on planes. Like, it is perfectly suited to extrovert Brian Brush. Like, what's going on, plane? It's me. How are you? Where are you out of? Oh, awesome. How many seats are open? Hey, this is my wacky buddy, Justin. I'm going to buy him a drink later.
I talk to, like, I mean, I get chatty with the gate. I've bought cookies and stuff for people at the gates and stuff, and I get that. I like my window. I just love my window seat. I just, if I'm stuck in the middle, I'm like, I don't know which way to lean, and I don't like the aisle. I got my preference. And so, like, if you tell me, like, oh, you're not going to get it, or maybe you will, I don't know. I'm like, oh, I'm going to drive.
Yeah.
And, like, When it comes to the pricing stuff, like, the their no fees thing is like legitimate. Like, you're not paying for a seat, you're not paying for more than two bags plus two carry-ons. It's because I think last year, maybe a year or so before, I flew United or American or something, and it was like sticker shock when I was like, oh yeah, this cheaper flight, suddenly, like, now you're paying for your seat, there's no seats available, oh, you have to pay because this is a basic economy seat and it doesn't even include a carry-on, so you got to pay to upgrade.
Oh, and you're gonna want, like, an air mask in case of a disaster.
Yeah. I mean, I genuinely believe that some of the decisions that major carriers have made in terms of, like, reducing what you get for your money, and, like, even now United pushing that this basic economy thing, which is, like, basically them walking more the line of, like, a Spirit airline or a Frontier, is just bad. It's just bad for business. It makes for a bad experience. And ultimately, it is just a trick. Like, it's to get you in there, and then, you know, they hit you with the upsell.
Hey, you don't actually want this seat. You just want economy, not basic. Yeah.
Which, like, so I hate that those even show up for me.
Let me throw out a kind of a, in the middle of our picks here, though, a weird things comment or observation we talked about before is we talked about, you know, the growth of like electric aircraft and stuff and self, you know, like fully robotic and stuff. I mean, could we imagine a future 20 years from now where, you know, you have these things capable of doing short hauls or 200, 300 miles or whatever, and you just go down to the nearest parking garage and hop on board one? And
I mean, I think there certainly is a design for it. You know, my although I've certainly come around on Southwest, my actual favorite airline these days is, you know, JSX, which was the former JetSuiteX, where they are, you know, they're effectively just a regional airline, things that have existed forever, but they just fly out of a private terminal where you can avoid the, you know, hassles of like TSA and stuff like that. And specifically for Oakland to Vegas, it's like cheaper than Southwest on that route if you're going at non-peak times. But if you're going to Vegas in the middle of the week, like it was, you know, downright affordable.
This reminds me a little bit of my recommendation from a few weeks ago, Alchemy, where it talks about like, you know, you would think that a faster plane would be what you want, but if, you know, if you could, as you figured out, if you could eliminate the TSA, then you, what you want is a shorter travel experience.
Exactly. Yeah. Cause it was like, you know, I went to go visit our buddy Will Harris and it was like driving to Sacramento. Like I just took a, you know, an Uber down to this thing. I just walked effectively right on the plane. Hour and a half later, I'm there in Vegas. Like it was remarkable.
Yeah. I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to see. Cause once I got my head away from thinking about using flying aircraft within the city to the idea of like, no, let's just go 150 miles away or 200 miles or this or that and ready whenever you need it. And it's like, I don't know.
I got a pick. You guys like that? Like Firefly? Do you guys like Firefly?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I wish more people would talk about it online, but I found it okay.
Do you guys like the good Fallout games, like Fallout 1 or Fallout New Vegas?
Yeah. Hey, well, hold on. Now you have my interest. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you like KOTOR? You're kind of a Knights of the Old Republic kind of fan?
Yeah. KOTOR. Yeah. No. What's happening? What's happening right now?
So Obsidian Entertainment, who made a lot of those games, have a new game out called The Outer Worlds.
No.
And it is pretty much all of those things. It's very cool.
Oh, how did I not know about this? This sounds awesome.
So it is a open, it's an RPG, a first person RPG, kind of in the vein of those 3D Fallout games, where you are one of like 10,000 people on a seed ship, the second seed ship, going out to the far edge of the universe to start a new colony. And you are awakened. It's only supposed to be a 10-year trip. You end up being awakened after like 70 years by this crazy doctor who is on the run from the police, and he saves just you. He's only able to save you, and so you sort of team up with him to save all of the other colonists who are stuck on this ship that the corporate government of this colony has deemed not worth reviving. And so it takes you to these different planets in this little solar system, and it's
so they're not doing like warp things. It's similar to Firefly. This is all just one very planet populated system.
Yeah. And it's not like Fallout where you have one huge open world map. It's like a lot of smaller open maps, and you're kind of playing off these different corporations. So the idea of this colony is a bunch of corporations teamed up together to buy this plot of land in space. And so they own it and they make the laws and they have controlled the society in this part of the universe for 70 odd years. And so people are born being employees of these companies. And when they get hurt, they get docked their pay for damage to company property. It's a very hyper corporate sort of society that you're put in,
or China today,
yeah. Sure,
or a new Elon on Mars 100 years from now.
And so you're supposed to. So this is a very early thing, but you're supposed to meet up with this guide on the first place that you land, But you accidentally land on top of the person because he landed the beacon, but he didn't realize he was supposed to walk away from it. So you step out and you just see these legs under you. So you end up taking his ship and getting a group of companions along the way who help you team up with the doctor to try to save.
And this is all a single player experience?
Yes.
It's freaking awesome. This sounds great. Cool.
And it's got a lot of choice options. There's reputation between all of the different colony or the different corporations. Lots of quests. Lots of shooting. The shooting's really good. I think it's really nice. And if you have on a PC or an Xbox, it's on the Xbox Game Pass. So on PC, that's like $5 a month. On Xbox, it's like $10 a month. But you can play this now as a part of it. It's a very cool game. It's certainly worth like a $5 or $10 try. One more time, The Outer Worlds is what it's called.
So stoked. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Very Andrew? Cool. I remember I saw a little write-up on it, and I just looked at that logo alone, the Outer Worlds logo, the way the O is, and I'm like, that's beautiful. That's
right. It looks like a rising sun with the horizon. Yeah.
Well, and it sort of harkens back to the golden age of science fiction with the typeface font.
And it does, that's kind of the aesthetic where like Fallout kind of had that 40s aesthetic. This has a little bit of that sort of almost steampunky aesthetic, but it's more high, more futuristic tech sort of stuff. You know, it's all like synthetic foods and like all sorts of different salves and creams and stuff. It's really neat. And the writing's very good.
Cool. My pick is simple. Netflix, Dolomite is my name.
Is that already on Netflix? Yeah. I saw that it was still showing at some Alamo locations here. I was really bummed that one didn't come to my local theater because the reviews were so good. And it seems like, and this is secondhand, third-hand information now that you're hearing it from me, but it's like, what if Eddie Murphy cared again and told interesting stories? Is that an accurate analysis?
It is. It's delightful. You've got the number of other people in this is fantastic. You've got Wesley Snipes in, you know, probably his first cool role that's not like a direct-to-video sort of thing. And I mean, it's just great. Eddie Murphy's great in it. The story, it's the story of Rudy Ray Moore and how he came to make the movie Dolomite, which this is a guy that tried and tried and tried to make it in the entertainment business and, you know, is in his like mid to late 40s. And finally came up with sort of this idea, and it just grew into something bigger and better, and he made himself into a film star and, you know, had an impact on cinema. And you know, the story of how this guy, you know, it reminds you a bit of, gosh, what was the Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy movie about trying to make... Yeah, Bowfinger. Yeah, a little bit of a Bowfinger sort of vibe to it, but this time, you know, Eddie Murphy being the Bowfinger type, the guy making the movie, but based on a true story. Again, just great performances all around. Like Wesley Snipes is just standout in it. So Dolomite is my name. So
that's great. Cool.
That's on Netflix.
Yep. There you go. It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.